Okay, well, the obvious answer to the question in the title of the talk is that, by all means, yes, we should be searching for extraterrestrial intelligence. So I could quit there, but I'm not going to, because I think the real question is, how should you search for it, and, you know, through what, you know, how great of an effort should you go to? Should it be an effort that's divorced from astrophysics, or should it be done jointly with astronomical kinds of surveys? And it, over the course of the hour, you'll come to recognize what my answer to the question really is. So, so I want to talk about extraterrestrial intelligence. Why should we search? What are the various rationales that can be invoked? That'll actually take a little bit of time, because there are some interesting opinions by various people that have been made over the years that kind of get people mad or excited or otherwise. But then I also want to talk about strategies and methods. You know, what are the kinds of signals that can and should be looked for, and a little bit about prospects for the future. Now, I want to partition what I talk about in the following way. I don't really want to talk so much about microbial life. In other words, I don't really want to talk about searches for microbial life in the universe. It's really intelligent technological life. So I'll define technological ETs as a species that has independently evolved, that somehow produces artificial events, perhaps electromagnetically, maybe through gravitational waves or whatever, but through some means that we can detect by remote sensing. So I don't want to talk about microbial life in the solar system. I don't want to talk about our spacecraft, which are now extraterrestrial. I don't want to talk about atmospheric modification of other Earth-like planets by bacteria. That, of course, is a big topic in and of itself, and I would say over the next 20 years, it's highly likely that we will detect Earth-like planets and other solar systems whose atmospheres have, in fact, been modified by microbial life, and that's an effort that will lead to the terrestrial planet finder. So I want to give you an indication of where I'm coming from on this, because my what I spend most of my time on really is studies of neutron stars, and that's why I'm here at the ITP for the neutron star program. And so as a consequence, I spent a lot of time using this telescope. This is the Arecibo telescope. It's the largest radio telescope in the world. It's 1,000 feet across. It's been in existence for about 40 years. And it has undergone an upgrade that was completed a few years ago, while putting in this ground screen, putting in Gregorian optics inside that dome, also putting in a 1 megawatt transmitter for use as for use in planetary radar studies. So one of the things I've been spending quite a bit of my time on recently is designing a survey using a multi-beam system such as has been used with the Parkes radio telescope.
There are chairs on this side.
Okay. But for use with Arecibo, and what I like to do, what I like spending my time on, is designing surveys, and in this case for pulsars, for neutron stars. And actually there's a lot of similarity in the way you design a pulsar survey and the way you would design a SETI survey. So for example, what we hope to do with Arecibo is a deep galactic plane survey using this multi-beam system. And with a little bit of hubris, asking for quite a bit of telescope time, we hope to double or even quintuple the number of known pulsars, maybe over the next 5 years or so. So that's the kind of thing I like to do. And there is a, like I say, there's a close similarity to SETI. And the reason we want to find more pulsars, of course, is because you can use them to probe gravity, stellar evolution, the equation of state of neutron stars. But what's relevant today to what I'm going to talk about is the way that we can use pulsars to probe the interstellar medium. As it turns out, there are propagation effects like dispersion that influence the pulsar signal. I'm showing here a pulse measured in different frequency channels. The high frequency channels, the pulse arrives earlier than later. That's simply the cold plasma dispersion law from the ionized gas in the interstellar medium. And what the relevant parameter is the dispersion measure. That's simply the column density of free electrons. Okay, those same free electrons have spatial variations, and the radiation from a compact source like a pulsar is diffracted by those small scale fluctuations, and we see multipath propagation manifested like this. This is a pulsar pulse, and the asymmetry here, this tail, is due to the fact that radiation is reaching us by various paths. So what this represents is about 100 milliseconds of excess delay on top of the entire propagation time, which is about 30,000 years for this particular pulsar. That's very easy to measure, and it, that same kind of effect is relevant to SETI. SETI signal. So the basic picture we have for the interstellar medium is that there is a distribution of turbulent plasma, which gives rise or is described as density fluctuations in the free electrons. If you have a spatially coherent source of radiation like a pulsar, the wavefronts are distorted, and far enough away you would see a diffraction pattern. We can measure that diffraction pattern quite easily. We do it all the time with pulsars. I'll show you some examples in a second, but the main point is that, again, that same effect will apply to ETI sources. The reason for that is that you have to have a high degree of spatial coherence. A pulsar is really the only natural source we know of today that's compact enough to show these diffraction effects. But by the same token, an ETI source, well, you know, is it from a planet or a spacecraft or what? It's still going to be small enough to have the same effects apply. Okay, so this is what we measure for pulsars, like we measure intensity versus frequency and time. A nearby pulsar, the diffraction pattern is sampled like this, big splotchy regions of constructive and destructive interference. If you look at a more distant pulsar in a self-similar way, those constructive and destructive interferences get smaller, and we know how that scales. So all that structure in here is due to the diffraction pattern. In this case, that's about 20 megahertz, and that's 10 megahertz. The vertical scale, that's roughly an hour. In both cases, that's actually 2 hours. Right, but anyway, we know what the scaling laws are for the time and characteristic, the characteristic time and characteristic frequency scale. It also involves the pulsar velocity, which is another story in itself. But again, my main point right now is that these same effects come into play when you, if you want to do a survey for extraterrestrial intelligence signals. And one thing that we're doing, this is another thing I spend quite a bit of my time on, is modeling the overall galactic distribution of the electron density and its fluctuations. This is sort of our current iteration on this. We're a little bit midstream, but we're, I would say by the end of the year we will publish this, but we have a spiral arm model. These little splotches here are our attempt to model the local ISM. The main usage of this model is for distances. If you can measure the dispersion measure to a pulsar, you can establish the distance. But you can also predict the scattering and scintillation parameters. I'm sorry?
ISM.
Interstellar medium. Yeah. Thanks for asking. And by all means, ask questions. So that's where I'm coming from. The pulsar world, and like I say, the pulsar world has a lot of crosstalk, if you like, with the SETI world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so why should we search? You know, how can we assess the odds? Well, it's basically a guessing game, but it's a semi-educated guessing game. Nobody really knows the answer, and I think the answer has to be gotten empirically, which is why you do need to do searches. But what I want to do is go through the astrophysical case. The astrophysical case is simply, you know, what is the probability of having habitable planets given the properties of the galaxy as we know it. There's the biological case, the probability of having life given planets. I think that probability is quite high if you're talking about microbes. I have no idea what the probability is if you're talking about complex technological life. I don't think anybody knows. But there, if any of you, any of you that have read the literature on this, will have come across references to the Copernican principle, the anthropic principle, and Fermi's paradox. The idea here of the Copernican principle is that we're not the center of anything. Mm-hmm. We're basically mediocre. This is sometimes called the assumption of mediocrity. So if we're so mediocre, there must be a lot more like us out there. The anthropic principle in the weak form is simply a restatement of the obvious fact that the universe better have had the properties.
Are you saying that we're so mediocre because we're not broadcasting yet?
Or? No. I'm just saying that we're not the center. Well, we are broadcasting.
Right. How far can the signal we broadcast be seen?
I'll talk about that. And I'll mention that. In some cases, it's quite far.
Uh-huh.
But we're not deliberately transmitting.
Right.
Okay, no, I'm just saying that we are mediocre in the cosmological sense. And if so, then there may, in fact, be lots of us out there doing our Homo sapiens thing. The anthropic principle is simply, the obvious statement that the universe better have the properties, the fundamental constants and age, so as to allow creatures like ourselves to have evolved. Some people go a bit further than this with the anthropic principle, but I think that's, I don't really want to get into that. I don't think it's relevant. The Fermi paradox goes on and says, okay, if we're so mediocre and there are lots of us in the galaxy, then where the hell are they? Because if we are common, there are sun-like planets that are a billion times older than our sun. In other words, there are civilizations that could have had a 5 billion year jump start on us. If so, maybe they partake of Star Trek, and where the hell are they? They're not obviously here, although some people might say that they are. I don't really think so. So what does that mean? And I'll talk more about that, but this is sort of the outline of
the
first part of my talk.
What is the evidence that I read about in the magazine about somebody having been here but have left very few tracks or just visited, and what's the evidence against
artifacts? I think there is no evidence.
There is no evidence.
No. I wouldn't give it the time of day.
Okay.
The astrophysical case is quite simple. If you look at stars and ask if you define a habitable zone in some fashion, and the fashion that I will define it is sort of the minimal version, that in what regions around stars are you likely to have liquid water for significant amounts of time, and significant means for longer than 3 billion years. In the case of the solar system, that's estimated to be about 0.2 astronomical units, and lo and behold, the Earth's orbit is safely in that range, and hence we're here. It looks like habitable zones are quite common if you define it in this fashion. It also looks, from the work of the last 5 years, the discoveries of new planets that we've heard about for the last 5 years, planetary systems appear to be quite common. Now, admittedly, the planets that are being found are not the kind where some people would say you want to find beachfront property like out here, and those planets that have been found will not have beachfront property. In fact, those planetary systems look to be a lot more complex and a lot different than the solar system. Those planets have orbits that are often highly elliptical, and their climates, if you like, would be highly unstable. Nonetheless, I take this as being an existence proof for Earth-like planets in a lot of situations. You can argue that elemental abundances are essentially universal, so the things we're made of are all over the universe, all over the galaxy. We think we understand pretty well how chemical evolution works in galaxies. Nucleosynthesis works according to the initial conditions given by the early universe with hydrogen and helium and a few trace elements. And we think that nucleosynthesis, by and large, is driven or determined in a parametric sense by the mass of a star. And we also think that the distribution function of masses, I guess the mass spectrum of stars, is also more or less universal. I mean, some people would quibble with that statement, but the current suspicion is that the mass spectrum of stars is somehow related to turbulence in molecular clouds, and that turbulence, by and large, looks Kolmogorov-like, more or less universal. So I think you put this all together, and you can really make the case that there's a significant amount of phase space for Earth-like conditions, and that's just using the kinds of conditions that we're based upon. If there are other kinds of habitable zones, maybe on satellites around giant planets like Jupiter, maybe other chemistries, well, that's all the better. Yeah. But I don't see it as any means chauvinistic to focus on water and our kind of life. I have the word here, caveats. That's because a number of people would argue against this logic that I'm claiming here. But just very quickly, there is water everywhere. It's we see it in comets. We see it, well, it's claimed to be on the moon, although I think that's highly disputed, and I tend to not believe it myself. It's found in molecular clouds, like in Orion. It certainly was on Mars. This is a canyon on Mars, and water may be lurking today right under the surface of Mars. It's also probably on some of the Jovian planets, like Callisto and Europa.
Forgive my ignorance. The comets are fairly local objects, is that?
They're all over the...
They can come from the other side of the galaxy?
Well, we don't know of any interstellar comets, actually.
So they are local?
They're local to the solar system for the most part, but they come from quite far out from past the orbit of Pluto. I just thought I'd advertise a little bit the existence of water, even on Mercury, the planet closest to the Sun. If you look at radar studies, if you use radar from Arecibo and look at the reflectivity, there are regions of excess reflectivity at the poles of Mercury, and these regions are in craters that are shielded from sunlight. They never see sunlight, or at least over long periods of time, they don't see sunlight. So the best guess is that this reflectivity is due to ice, and that ice has derived from cometary impacts, most likely. So even in these, so water is all over the place. There are quantitative studies of habitable zones. This is a famous paper by Casting et al., where they analyze greenhouse effects, runaway glaciation on planets. Their conclusion is that if you define the continuously habitable zone in the fashion I did, liquid water for 3 billion years, that if you want to search for extraterrestrial life, it should be around G-type stars like the Sun, and ones that are slightly more massive and slightly less massive. Not a huge surprise, but the trade-off is that these kinds of stars are much longer lived than, say, the very massive stars, and also their habitable zones are bigger. Okay, so that's the astrophysical case. I think it's set. I'll say a little bit about the biological case. The biological case is that the building blocks for making organic processes go are also ubiquitous. So organic molecules are found all over the place, interstellar gas clouds. Radio spectroscopy indicates that there are quite complex molecules, even in these very tenuous molecular clouds. We see those molecules in comets. Evidently, on the early Earth, right after or shortly after the late heavy bombardment finished, that's when the last planetesimals stopped bombarding the Earth. Within maybe 100 million years, life had formed. There's fossil evidence for bacteria that are quite old. So the suspicion is that chemistry began, or at least biochemistry began, with what people call the RNA world. RNA is an autocatalytic molecule, and in some ways is more fundamental than DNA. DNA requires RNA for protein synthesis. So this is the basic idea. It's unprovable at the present time, but through laboratory studies and modeling, this is the kind of picture that people are looking at. So I'm inclined to think, in my simplistic physicist outlook, that this version of life is quite simple, that it's really a matter of chemistry. And if there are any biologists in the audience, I'm sure you might complain about that glibness, but it looks to me like that's the case. There may be alternative chemistries, but again, that's sort of gravy added on top of the picture that that we know.
Building blocks, what is the biggest?
Oh, it's totally hierarchical. I mean, once you start with molecules, you start with the simplest bacteria. Lynn Margulis likes to make more complex unicellular entities out of fusion of bacteria.
In the interstellar clouds.
In interstellar clouds, I'll show you a list of molecules shortly. But with complex life on Earth, it's very clear that complex life has been sculpted by catastrophes. There are six major extinction events that have happened since the Cambrian explosion between 5 and 600 million years ago. We all know the dinosaur story, and in that sense, at least the lore is that by virtue of the dinosaurs becoming extinct, ecological niches became available to mammals, and here we are. I'm not sure how provable that is, but it's a nice story. So that says impacts are good because it's an impact that caused the KT extinction 65 million years ago. But impacts are also bad because we're sort of due for one. And if one were to happen next week, it would be pretty bad for us. But I also wonder, would Homo sapiens really become extinct? I came of age in the 60s, and I remember quite well the Cuban Missile Crisis, when a lot of people built bomb shelters. And who knows, maybe it's the guys with all kinds of, you know, stockpiles of guns and food are the ones that'll survive. That's a sobering thought, I think. Yes.
Just to elaborate on that, the idea is that you get into dead ends if you don't, evolutionary dead ends or something.
You mean if you don't stir things up?
Things out with an impact?
Yeah, that could also be a rationale for saying that extinction events are good.
But that is the thinking that you need that kind of thing.
It promotes speciation.
Okay.
Yeah. So who knows? Maybe there's an optimal event rate, an optimal impact rate that a solar system has to have in order to generate intelligent technological life. So you can ask these kinds of questions. Is technology and intelligence inevitable? I can't really come up with a definition of intelligence in a finite amount of time, so I won't bother, but I think it's easy to define technology. And here just means technology that produces signals that we could detect with our technology. So is it inevitable? I don't know. Why did it take so long to evolve on Earth? It took a long time after the dinosaurs became extinct that we came around as a technological species. So you can also ask the question, this is another way of phrasing it, did we come along late in the game or early in the game compared to other solar systems? And we don't know. Okay, just a quick list of some of the molecules that have been measured in interstellar molecular clouds, ranging from simple to very complex organics. People have looked for buckyballs, not without success so far, but presumably they're out there. Yes, there's enough alcohol out there to keep everybody inebriated for cosmological times, I think. Okay, well, I like these quotes from Lynn Margulis. One is that she basically equates the formation of the first bacterial cell with the same thing as asking how did life originate. And in her picture, more complex unicellular entities become more complex by fusion of simpler bacteria. So mitochondria and various other things in cells, she thinks, are from the fusion. And then there's this other quote from her that is referring to the Miller-Urey experiments of zapping primordial gas-like atmospheres and getting amino acids out. And she says if a 22-year-old can do that in a few days, why couldn't it happen on Earth? Maybe we could cover that or power it down or something. Anyway, if that can happen in a few days in a lab, then why couldn't it happen relatively quickly on our Earth and on any Earth?
So she's posing this as a paradox or a puzzle or something?
No, she's posing it as an existence proof, I think, for
that it could easily happen.
That it should easily happen. Right. Let me just clear this up here. Is it off? Okay, it's off. Great. Okay, so that's basically the biological argument, at least as far as I will take it. That again, microbial life is simple, complex life, it's up in the air. I'd like to make the astronomical case, because we live now in the 21st century in the era of large-scale astronomical surveys. So in the electromagnetic spectrum, there are several radio surveys of the sky, the NVSS, that's the NRAO VLA Sky Survey that I'll show you an example of in a minute. There are others, pulsar, large-scale pulsar surveys. In the infrared, there's the 2-micron astronomical sky survey. There's the Sloan Digital Sky Survey in the optical. And then, of course, up into the X-rays and gamma rays. We're just moving into gravitational waves. Neutrino astronomy has existed for a while, and certainly cosmic ray astronomy for a long time. But the point I really want to make is that in spite of these very deep surveys, that each of which identifies many millions of sources, we are still just, it's still just a drop in the bucket of what's out there. We have not properly surveyed the sky in any sense of the word. And that's one of the lessons, and I think that's one of the arguments I'd make, is that we have not covered the phase space, the observational phase space, that would allow us to detect signals of any variety produced by extraterrestrials. So just as an indication of how well we know things, here is basically what the galaxy looks like all across the spectrum, going from relatively low radio frequencies at 400 megahertz. That radiation is predominantly from cosmic ray electrons. Going all the way up to gamma rays, that radiation is due to cosmic ray ions, and everything in between, molecular hydrogen, atomic hydrogen, dust in the infrared, stars in the optical, and so forth. So we know a lot about what the galaxy looks like, and again, my point is we still don't know enough to make any kind of claim as to what the population of other civilizations might be in the galaxy. So here's an example of a radio survey, the NRAO VLA survey. This was conducted in the 1990s. It identified about 2 million sources above a flux of 2 millijanskis. That's a preferred radio astronomy flux unit. But what I'm showing here in this projection, this is in galactic coordinates. So there's the galactic equator. You can see excess counts of sources here along the equator. And each and every one of these points here is a radio source, and most of these are extragalactic sources. And it looks pretty uniform, as you would expect from cosmological considerations. Now, if you go in, and I should also say that this is only 65,000 of the 2 million sources. If I plotted all 2 million, that would be completely black. So I did a flux cut just to show that. You can zoom in on particular ones of those sources. And for example, we'll see the contours here are the radio contours, the radio flux, and then the grayscale is the optical, what the optical field looks like. For the most part, you don't see an optical counterpart to the radio source. Here you do, because that's a globular cluster. This is a millisecond pulsar. This is a double extragalactic radio galaxy. You can zoom in even more. And if you were to do this for many of those sources in my projection plot there, you might see things like this. This is sort of a garden variety radio galaxy, giant black hole there, jets emanating outwards and so forth. So most of those sources in that plot are of this type. They're basically a dime a dozen. But the point really is that each and every one of those sources will not be subjected, at least not in the near term, to that kind of scrutiny. And for the most part, only a small fraction of those several million sources will be identified in a detailed way. They may be identified statistically by looking at colors and so forth. And so that's one of my points. The other point is that the sky is really incompletely surveyed in spite of these large-scale surveys, especially if you want to consider transient signals and narrow-band signals, which are of the type considered for SETI. The surveys have not been done. All right, well, again, those of you that have read some of the literature or heard other talks about SETI will have invariably heard of the Drake equation. The Drake equation is really just a beam counting back of the envelope estimation procedure that allows you to kind of put down the factors that you think are relevant. So for example, what N here means is it's supposed to be an estimate of the number of transmitting civilizations in the galaxy. So you can start off with the star formation rate. If you take a rate and multiply it by a time, that's what L is for longevity. And here I mean that to be the longevity of a civilization, of a typical civilization in transmitting mode, in a mode that we could detect. So a rate times a time gives you a number. These factors in between are all those other factors that you think are relevant for determining the number of civilizations. So for example, we know the star formation rate, it's about 30 stars per year in the galaxy. What fraction are sun-like? By sun-like I mean of the order of the same mass of the sun, but also not in binary systems. Most stars are in multiple star systems. The number of planets in each solar system, the fraction of those that are in habitable zones, that's pretty much all astrophysics right there. And then you get into biology, the fraction of those planets in the habitable zone that have life. That may be chemistry, or maybe more complex biology, I don't know. But once you get to the factor of, you know, what fraction have intelligence and technology, that's up in the air. And then you can lump together a whole bunch of other nasty effects that you might worry about in this business, and I'm just calling that F other. If you're a real optimist about, let's say, occupancy in the habitable zone and these other factors that I'm lumping together, then it works out that these pretty much factor into unity and you get N is approximately equal to longevity. So if you're an optimist about our longevity and you think we're typical, then let's say we're going to live as a transmitting civilization for 1 million years. Well, then you would estimate that there are about 1 million such civilizations in the galaxy. It's as simple as that. But, you know, we don't really know that these factors are yield some a net factor of order unity. The pessimistic view expressed by some people is that, well, gee, maybe the habitable zone isn't so well occupied in general, and also there are these other factors that might really diminish the number of civilizations in the galaxy. Some people go so far as to say that N equals 1 and we're it. And that's a very sobering thought, I think. Anyway, what do people worry about? There's a book that was published this year called Rare Earth that some of you may have read by Ward and Brownlee. They list a number of effects such as the extinction rate maybe being tied to whether you have a Jupiter in your solar system that can deflect comets away from you. That would influence the extinction rate on our kind of planet. There may be a fine-tuning of planetary properties. If you really need Earth-like conditions in the strict sense, then maybe you have to worry about, you know, how much of an ocean do you have? Is the planet covered entirely, or do you have too little of an ocean? Is plate tectonics a key issue? Spin axis stability is probably an issue. We are very different. That is, Earth is very different in having a moon that is so high in mass relative to the planetary mass, and that's very key to the spin axis stability, issues of orbital stability. These guys talked about habitable zones with respect to location in the galaxy. In my opinion, they went way overboard in the opposite direction that the real SETI enthusiasts go way overboard in the optimistic direction. So for example, the subtitle of their book is Why Complex Life is Uncommon in the Universe, as if they really know that it is. I think it sold books though.
They're both astrophysicists, right?
No, one is a biologist who specializes in extinctions. That's Ward. Brownlee, you've heard of Brownlee particles? Dust particles captured from the solar system in the Earth's atmosphere. Okay, well, let's not be over-optimistic or over-pessimistic, but let's look at the longevity issue. Certainly our longevity is linked, at least for the moment, to the longevity of the sun. What I'm showing here is the luminosity of the sun versus time. The important part of the luminosity's evolution for us is the main sequence portion here, where the sun burns hydrogen. The luminosity increases continuously throughout that range. We're about halfway through the life of the sun in the main sequence phase. I think I would argue that we probably won't be able to live on Earth. That is, Earth will not be in the habitable zone for the entire duration of the sun's main sequence lifetime, maybe for another billion years. And at that point, we would probably undergo the same effects that have happened on Venus, which is a runaway greenhouse effect. And we know that Venus is a nasty place to live or not live. So that's an upper bound on longevity, but a billion years, it's a lot to work with. There's the impact issue. There's a very, well, impacts have been, have captured a lot of interest ever since Alvarez et al. Established that the KT of extinction event was due to an asteroidal impact. I'm sorry?
That's well established?
Sure, if you take a vote, I'm sure you'd get, you'll do much better than either of the presidential candidates. but anyway, this is a paper from the mid-1990s, and they assessed the current hazard. And like I said before, we're basically due for a fairly big impact.
Next century.
Well, they state here, that there's a 1 in 10,000 chance that a large asteroid will collide with us in the next 100 years and will kill a large fraction of us. So we may not find the answer to David's 10 physics questions. but another way that they put it, which is kind of interesting, is that each of us has as much likelihood of dying in an airline accident as we do of dying from an impact. All right, then another article that I would like to kind of point to, and I think many of you know about this. This is by Richard Gott from Princeton. And it invokes the Copernican principle, and unlike most invocations of it, which talk about spatial issues, that is, that we're not at the center of anything, here Gott talks about the temporal axis. And his basic statement is that if we are random observers occurring in the lifetime of our species, there's basically a confidence interval that we will land in as current observers, according to the Copernican principle, and thereby we can define what our longevity will be. I can't do justice to this argument. I actually hand this article out to one of my classes, and we discuss it, and it's amazing how worked up people will get about this. It's really a great article if you want to excite people. But the basic argument is what he calls the delta T argument. I don't know if you can read it, but the basic idea is that we as a species have been around for, it depends on how you want to define it, let's say a million years. Depends on which ancestors we want to recognize. But anyway, so if we've been around for a time T past, then the 95% confidence interval says that we will extend into the future by an amount that ranges between 1/39th of T past and 39 times T past.
Where does the number
39 come from? It's the 95% confidence interval.
From the
Gaussian. Yeah, so this sounds very simple. It completely glosses over issues of intelligence and whether that's an evolutionarily favorable thing to have. He says it doesn't matter, that we're no better or no worse than any other species. And what's amazing is he applies this to a few examples, such as the longevity of Stonehenge and the Berlin Wall, and it sort of works, and it's kind of uncanny. But he didn't apply it in this article, but there was an article in the New York Times where he talked about how long you'll have to wait till the Boston Red Sox win their next World Series. And it ranges from a few years up to 3,000 years. So those of you, there's an arcane thing in baseball called the curse of the Bambino, which has to do with Babe Ruth and how he was traded from the Red Sox to the Yankees. And if it's another 3,000 years before the Red Sox win the World Series, then the curse of the Bambino is really quite severe. Okay, but I highly recommend those articles because at the very least they're fun. I'm not really convinced myself that what Gott says is really relevant to our longevity. And I can talk to people afterwards about that. Okay, the Fermi paradox. Again, if you are an optimist about numbers of civilizations, you think N is big, then where are they? If N is big, then there must be civilizations much more advanced than we are. If you think space travel is simple, then they should have been here by now. At least so the statement goes. And this was a question apparently raised by Enrico Fermi at a conference in the late 1940s. And one answer to it, which is very aggravating, I think, is by Barrow and Tipler. There's a very thick book called The Anthropic Cosmological Principle. It's very well written, but aggravating. And the statement, I'll summarize the argument here. Okay, if they did exist and possessed the technology for interstellar communication, they would also have developed interstellar travel, and they would all already be here. Since they are not here, this implies they don't exist. N equals 1, QED. There are some holes in that argument, which Bill Newman and Carl Sagan nicely discussed. They actually looked at how diffusion through the galaxy might actually happen, and they analyzed this mathematically by analogy with the way species diffuse on the surface of the Earth. And this is their conclusion. We conclude that the Earth is uncolonized, not because space-faring societies are rare, but simply there are too many places for them to go to in the galaxy. There are too many rest stops. Yes. And there's no shortage of explanations. In fact, there's a flowchart in this book called The Biological Universe by Stephen Dick. This is an extremely well-written book. He's a historian of science. So explanations for the apparent absence of extraterrestrials on Earth, they range from they don't exist to they exist, but they don't like to travel, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
I read recently the figure for the rate of expansion, which I hadn't thought of until I read this article, and I'm surprised how slow it is.
The rate of expansion terrestrially?
The rate of, for a civilization like ours within the near future, like start to colonize the galaxy, it would take 5 million years to colonize the galaxy.
Right, and say, yeah.
As you were saying before, you know, less than 1% of the life time.
Yes.
It's almost instantaneous.
It could be.
That should be said in this background, because you're talking about blowing out events that are almost.
Well, the light travel time across the galaxy is, let's see, maybe 100,000 years. So if you really went ballistically,
and ballistic, just
yeah, I know,
exponential growth.
Right. But if you look at it in a diffusion sense, the time scale is actually, the estimate is maybe a factor of 50, even longer. No, a factor of 50 longer than what you said. So more like hundreds of millions. But even short with, it's not exponential growth, it's with these growth curves according to like the logistic curve and populations. But you have to ask why, what would be the motivation for colonizing the galaxy? It might be that it's a winner-takes-all situation, that you can best defend yourself by taking over the entire galaxy.
But the spread of life on our Earth isn't always, there's not necessarily any advantage for the path. There's advantage for DNA, of course.
Right.
And the ants that spread from South America don't get any advantage from the fact that their cousins are in California.
That's true.
It just happens because that's
sure.
How evolution works.
But I guess if you think that technological civilizations are not benign, is Homo sapiens benign or not? I think sometimes yes, but a lot of times no. And so you might want to protect yourself from us. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of thing you can speculate about. And again, it's like estimating how many angels can dance on a pinhead, I think. You can't get very far, and I think the real answer is you got to do it empirically. Well, what does Richard Gott say? Well, almost surprisingly, he says, I am a strong supporter of SETI. I do predict that a targeted radio search of the nearby stars is not likely to be successful, but he does like the notion of an all-sky radio search. And I'll be talking about this in just a minute. He goes on to say, my answer to Fermi's question, where are they, is that they're basically at home, just like the rest of us. Because as he says, as a random intelligent observer, it would be improbable for you to find yourself sitting on your species' home planet of origin if species tended to propagate. And he also has 95% confidence limit on the number of civilizations, and it's exactly 121. Okay, so that's all speculation and rationale, and you know, it's fun to talk about. I'd like to discuss strategies about SETI, and you know, what can and should people actually do. Well, SETI is actually pretty old. It goes back to, as far as I know, 1924, motivated by Percival Lowell and his claims about canals on Mars. So the U.S. Army did the first SETI that I know of. Here's a guy listening with headphones for transmissions from Mars during a close apparition. As far as I know, this is the only real SETI that was conducted with headphones. In the movie Contact, that was totally bogus. So what should we look for? I think by reciprocity, we can't guess. I don't think we can guess very well what our technology will be like in 100 years. We can ask the 10 physics questions, and I would bet that those 100 years from now, people will look back on those questions and say, yeah, a lot of those questions are good ones, and we know the answer now. But I think if we had to predict or made an attempt to predict technology, we'd be way off base. We'd have a minor league batting average, I think. So the best we can do is really extrapolate from what we radiate now. And in the radio, this gets to your question, Tony, the typical workaday transmissions, FM radio stations, and so forth, if you work hard, they could probably be detected a few parsecs away. The strongest transmission is really from the Arecibo telescope. That's a megawatt in essentially a monochromatic signal, about 1 hertz wide, and that's detectable a good kiloparsec away. So about 3,000 years from now, somebody out at a kiloparsec might actually detect that signal.
And what is the signal?
It's I know that. Yeah, that's right. It's really diabolical. But what was the question?
What signal would they detect?
They would see a very sharp spectral line in the radio. That would be much sharper than any natural astrophysical source. Not much information. There would be a Barker code, you know, a very low bit rate code. But like Martin was suggesting, it's likely to never repeat for that poor graduate student, let's say, on that planet. So that's diabolically, because the way the radar is used is to target asteroids and planets in our solar system, and nothing to do with the background. Okay. Well, Arecibo is used about 10% of the time in radar mode. Okay, optically, we...
In
terms of the telescope schedule, it's about 10% of the time. So yeah, and with a duty cycle, maybe 20% or something. Yeah. Okay, optically, I think we are transmitting essentially nothing. You can look in the infrared. It turns out that pulsed infrared lasers could be detected. If you design them to be detected, they could be detected a few tens of parsecs away. That's something that Charlie Towns advocates. So I have gamma rays. Even a nuclear war isn't detectable very far. So a megaton is detectable maybe an astronomical unit away. Okay, so what is the rationale for doing searches in the radio? This goes back to, these are the classics, Kekkonen and Morrison in 1959, Frank Drake in 1960, and other authors. Basically, there's no galactic absorption of radio waves, unlike optical. There's no significant background from host stars because they are very dim in the radio. If you look at the microwave background signals from the galaxy and also from our atmosphere, if you're doing ground-based searches, then you would expect to get maximum signal to noise in the microwave band, roughly 1 to 10 gigahertz. People have made so-called magic frequency arguments where, and what I should say here is that there is what I call the strong SETI proponents that advocate that there are civilizations out there that might deliberately send signals to us that are easy to detect. Why they would want to do that, well, I think it's wishful thinking myself, but let's pretend that that's the case. And if you wanted to design, if you had a designer signal, you might transmit an Arecibo radar-like signal, almost monochromatic, much narrower than a natural thermal Doppler line width, and you would place it nearby a natural line like the 21 centimeter line of hydrogen or the 18 centimeter line of the OH molecule. So people have conducted surveys along those lines. Like I've already said, narrowband signals of that type would be, they would stand out like a sore thumb compared to natural astrophysical sources. Another element of this is propagation effects. This is something that I would add, that I have added to this list, because even though these propagation effects can have a bad effect on surveys, nonetheless, if you detect a signal from a civilization and you measure these propagation effects, then you can establish the distance of the source. So they're actually very useful for, in an astrophysical sense. The rationale for the infrared, this is something much more recent. Charlie Townes has been pushing the idea of using pulse lasers, and you could make a laser signal easily distinguishable from the significant infrared background from the host star. I didn't hear the first.
Your gamma ray case is in the nuclear war.
Yes.
Inside the atmosphere,
they're not getting out there. That's absolutely true. But if it's Star Wars and missiles. There's a quick picture of the sky background in the radio just to illustrate the 1 to 10 gigahertz range. This is the synchrotron background from interstellar electrons. This is atmospheric background. So the minimum in the background noise is in this so-called water hole where you have the hydrogen and OH lines. So historically, that's been the focus of a lot of SETI. All right, well, let's look at the question of how far should we look? This is completely or very closely connected to how many civilizations you think might exist. So here's my little model of the galaxy. It has a little pancake with some scale height and radial scale. The aspect ratio there is about 150. This is about 30 kiloparsecs in diameter and maybe, let's say, 200 parsecs in thickness. So the number of how far, the typical distance between civilizations will then scale according to whether you have lots of civilizations, so you have a spherical distribution close to you, or if there are very few civilizations, then you would have more or less a two-dimensional distribution. So anyway, the magic number here is 10 to the 4.5 civilizations. If you have fewer than that, then this distance will scale like r to the n minus 1, n to the minus 1 half, so 15 kiloparsecs times 1 over root n. But if you have lots of civilizations, then it would scale like n to the minus 1 third power. So if you're really an optimist in this business, like some people are, like at the SETI Institute, if you believe that the nearest source is just a few tens of parsecs away, then you are implicitly or even explicitly saying that there are lots of civilizations in the galaxy by necessity, by the Copernican principle, basically. So you might say that there's something like 100 million, upwards of 100 million civilizations in the galaxy, and so a strategy would be that you would target nearby stars. That indeed was Frank Drake's original survey in 1960. He looked at two nearby stars, didn't find anything. NASA conducted over all the 1990s, and it was canceled for budgetary reasons. But one component of that was the targeted search, and now the SETI Institute has picked that up with private money, and it's now called Project Phoenix. And I believe that, I know this month they've been at Arecibo conducting this search, and I think even as we speak, they're conducting this search. But really, you would have to be a super optimist to believe that that's a workable strategy. Somewhat more soberly, let's say there are 1,000 civilizations in the galaxy, then you're talking about 500 parsec typical separations. There, the strategy would be that you should do a blind sky survey, not target individual stars. You should just do a sky survey of the galactic plane. The NASA project had an element of a sky survey. It was never done. It wasn't picked up in the way NASA originally planned. There are some programs that you may have heard about called Serendip. There's one conducted at Arecibo, one at Parks in Australia, one in Argentina, and these are all blind surveys, but actually covering a very small chunk of the spectrum. And then some of you, I'm sure, have SETI at home running on your PCs. And if you are, that's essentially a blind survey using data from Arecibo. If you are a non-Copernican and believe that n equals 1, well, then you don't bother searching. And some people, in fact, say that SETI is worthless because n, in fact, does equal 1. So let's see. There are a few more things I'd like to discuss here, but it'll just take a few more minutes, I think. So the point is that how far we need to search is directly related to our optimism about these key factors in the Drake equation, longevity and some of these other factors. And you know, there's no way to answer that, really, not a priori. The second thing is that how far you have to look determines the role of propagation effects on radiated signals. So in the radio, there is the scintillation modulation that I talked about. The fading in and out of signals, that actually is very important in any kind of survey of, let's say, of pulsars, and certainly for in SETI. If you look at distant objects, then let's suppose you have a modulated signal. There's some information in the transmitted signal. That will get smeared out by pulse broadening if you're very far away, and depending on frequency, of course. There can also be spectral broadening, so a very narrow transmitted line can be broadened by the combined effects of scattering and Doppler shifts. In the infrared, there can be pulse broadening from grain scattering. So all this kind of works together, and if you want to design a survey, you really have to take this stuff into account. So if you're a strong SETI component, or a proponent, rather, and believe that there are intended signals transmitted towards us, then the signal is thought to be of this form, narrow band. This is essentially what I've talked about before. Narrow band, it might have been Doppler corrected in part for the motion of the transmitter around its host star, if there is a host star. It might be weakly modulated, so that at least there's some information in the signal, but probably a low bit rate. So what you would see, and what people do in surveys is to sample the what we call the undetected signal, and you Fourier analyze it. You have no background noise in that signal, and hopefully, if you're an optimist, you'll have a signal, narrow band like this, but you have to work against the exponential statistics in the power spectrum that occur. The exponential statistics means you have a long tail to the distribution, and it becomes quite a big statistical effort to sort out all the possibilities. And the other thing I will say is that given that at least these proponents say that it's an extremely narrow band signal, less than a hertz, but you have no idea where in the radio spectrum, let's say between 1 and 10 gigahertz, where that signal might lie. So you have a hell of a lot of possibilities. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a second. But this is what you might do then, is if you pointed a given position on the sky, you would be looking at the frequency time plane here. Maybe over a total band of some multiple of gigahertz, a time that might be hours. Individual spectra might be just a few seconds in duration. So the signal that you might see would look something like this, maybe narrow band. It would have a drift rate due to Doppler acceleration. There may be modulations intrinsic, perhaps also due to scintillations. And you have to, and this is all buried in noise, so you have to sort all that out. When you do the statistics and look at all the trials that you have to do in a major survey, typically you're doing many tens of, 10 to the 13 trials. And so if you want to avoid having significant numbers of false alarms in your detection scheme, you have to go to a high threshold, something like 30 sigma. And so you're in a regime of detection statistics that's quite unusual. The other aspect of this, the reality is that radio interference of terrestrial man-made origin is getting worse all the time, and it really interferes with finding these kinds of signals. But the irony of it is that if we could detect the equivalent of our radio interference, that would be a major discovery. But anyway, what this pushes people to doing in site observation coincidence testing. Okay, let me just say a few words about a survey done by Paul Horowitz at Harvard. This was called META. It was conducted in the late 80s and early 90s. It was essentially a magic frequency search. And he was looking at 1420 megahertz near the 21 centimeter line, also the second harmonic. He looked at a lot of sky positions over the course of 5 years, did 6 × 10^13 tests, and found 37 candidate events that sort of passed all the tests that he could come with for filtering out radio frequency interference and the exponential noise statistics. But the downside of that is that none of them ever repeated. And he looked at the same sky position for hundreds of times and never saw anything. So there are a number of explanations for this. One is that they're just totally bogus. In fact, Paul himself thinks that they are probably due to rare semiconductor events, maybe analogous to cosmic ray hits in CCDs. But you can also ask the question of, could these be the real thing, but scintillation has played a role? If you're at this 30 sigma level in your detection threshold, and you combine the noise statistics with scintillations, well, scintillations also follow, the modulation follows an exponential curve. We know that very well from theory and observation. So you can easily have a situation like this where your spectral line is sometimes modulated high, but more often it's going to be modulated low. So if you're doing a huge number of statistical trials, you might pick out 37 events out of 6 × 10^13, and you will never see the thing again. And actually, that kind of picture works, given the parameters of the META survey. So actually, just not long before Carl Sagan died, we worked on this paper called Scintillation-Induced Intermittency in SETI, and basically we applied this analysis, a Bayesian analysis to the META survey, and found that indeed you cannot rule out those signals as being real. That doesn't mean I believe they're real. I think they're probably, you know, of hardware origin. But nonetheless, if you to assess what's going on, it's not trivial. The last thing I'll say before I really conclude is that if you want to optimize a SETI survey against scintillation, you have to consider how to allocate your telescope time. Like, for example, if you want to look at a given star or position on the sky, and you have some amount of time you want to commit to that, is it better to do it all in one fell swoop or to chop it up so that you can do different, so you can draw different statistical trials of the scintillations? The characteristic scintillation time at SETI-type frequencies is maybe hours. The answer is that it is better to chop up your time so you can increase the odds that you're out on the tail of the scintillation distribution. So I won't explain these curves, but you can look at this quantitatively, and it turns out that the optimal number of trials is about 4. So, you know, that's the kind of optimization that can be done. Okay, so I'll finish now just by summarizing some of the things that I've said, but also making a few what are maybe sociological comments. Basically, the observational phase space is very incompletely covered so far. You cannot say anything about N, the number of civilizations, based on the surveys that have been done, in my estimation. And by the same token, if you have a priori estimates for N using the Drake equation, that certainly strongly influences what kind of survey that you would choose to do. Do you do a targeted one or a blind survey? What kind of propagation effects do you try to mitigate or exploit? I think that any SETI strategy, let's say based on magic frequencies or other notions that really rely on guessing at what the motivations might be of extraterrestrials, I think that they're completely unrobust about their ability to falsify anything. Okay, and then in terms of sociology or maybe reality, number 4 is that I would say that the SETI surveys that have been conducted have yielded no astrophysical spin-off, and I think that's a bad thing. So, for example, in the larger time that have been committed to SETI, there have been no new pulsars, no new masers, and certainly no new classes of objects. And I think most people would expect that if you open up the phase space, you should find new objects, perhaps. Well, I think that the way to proceed, like some of the, well, what Tony mentioned early on was the, in the introduction, was the Allen Telescope Array. This is the one funded by the co-founder of Microsoft, being built up in Hat Creek. That's really a prototype for the Square Kilometer Array, which is an international project, probably won't be started until 2010 at best. But anyway, this project, the SKA, got very high marks in the U.S. decadal survey for what we should be doing in terms of building astronomical instruments. And my feeling is that you design this thing to do astrophysics, and you let SETI be a spin-off of that. That may not make some of my friends very happy, but that's really the way I think it should be done. So what SETI can do is leverage itself off of Moore's Law, because really what you have to do SETI is very sophisticated digital processing at the back end. So that's my take on all this, and I'll finish with that.
I'm sure there are a lot of questions, David.
Aside from that one article by Horowitz, have there been other events that are equally significant?
Yes. One of the Serendip programs identified events that passed the criteria but didn't pan out in the sense of being repeatable. So it might be like the radar signal from Arecibo, that just doesn't repeat. But yeah, and whether that's, a simple, we're in an event space, you're looking at rare events, whatever their nature is, whether it's terrestrial or extraterrestrial. So it's a real difficult regime to work in. So it just takes persistence. But yeah, it's kind of a common, they are commonly uncommon, I guess.
Question here.
Leah.
You said that the target of this kind of observation are not actually intelligent societies, but technological societies.
Yes.
So, and from that point of view, I was very suspicious about the so-called Copernican computation, because if you take, instead of the time scale of the intelligence.
So you mean Richard Gotts?
Yes. You would come out with a very pessimistic conclusion about the chance of finding other technological societies.
Well, yes and no. I mean, he would say that Homo sapiens will last maybe a few million years, just like any other mammalian species. Yeah. And if it's a million years, then there might be a million civilizations in the galaxy.
You should put 100 years instead of a million years, because that's the time scale of the technological society.
So far.
Yeah.
Yeah, but what his estimate is how far, how far can you extrapolate into the future? And his estimate is perhaps up to 8 million years.
And on the other hand, we will continue as a technological society going on exponentially. After how many years it would be easily detectable from everywhere in the galaxy?
I mean, simply because we've populated.
Because the technological technology.
Okay, what's exponentially increasing?
And also our ability to search.
Our ability to search or to transmit?
To
transmit. Are we transmitting? I don't think we would end up being in a micro if we transmitting power.
No, we might construct one of these Dyson power systems.
Mm-hmm. That's true, but then that would be the infrared. Yeah. And who knows, maybe one of those two-mast infrared sources is one of those.
If someone out there is trying to detect the kind of man-made radiation we are generating today,
right?
How close do they have to be to know that there's intelligent?
For the typical signal, a few parsecs. So very close by, the very nearest stars, but not very far.
There's a question back there. You had a question.
Yes, my question is, the solar system radiation has started only about 100 years ago. If you assume that million year, we are probably like at the very, very beginning.
Right.
Normally we expect others to be able to find out first. It doesn't make sense to stop right now.
It doesn't make sense to start right now?
Because 100 years out of the media which we have.
That's right.
The chance of other civilization, and we saw the others which emit stuff, are going to be older than us.
That's right. Yeah, the big fraction of them will be much more advanced than we are. Maybe they don't use radio because it's so primitive. It's entirely possible.
Question from back. So what can we say about canon right now? Take everything and put it all together. We know that there's an element in Antarctica, for example. So we know that there isn't anything in like our immediate vicinity.
Yeah.
On N.
Right.
What, if everything that we know right now, what is the upper bound on N?
Okay, well, the absolute upper bound is probably the number of sun-like stars that are isolated, that is not in binaries, which is about 10 to the 11 stars. But if you say there's no civilization within 50 light years of us, then you're probably down at the 10 to the 9 level. So it's very high.
I have a sort of sociological question. How many groups of people among the statistics are seriously doing study programs?
Let's.
How often this thing appears in grant proposals?
Well, that's a very good question. I meant to mention that in the U.S. today, there is no publicly funded SETI. It's all privately funded. The SETI Institute has an endowment. There's a Planetary Society.
So you're doing it like a hobby, for example? Or?
Well, I'm not current. Put it this way. Most of my science is motivated by doing neutron star studies. But it's always in the back of my mind that I should be alert to things that I'm not intentionally looking for. So in a sense, we're all doing SETI. Even Martin, perhaps. But in terms of deliberately doing it, I've only done one deliberate program, and that it was just a small thing at Arecibo.
But Cornell people only seem to have published so many papers on this thing.
I think that there is a sociological issue there having to do with how many papers appear in referee journals and how many in just conference proceedings. There are very few that have appeared in referee journals, and I think that's a problem.
Other questions in the back?
Have there been any estimates when you talk about the situation for the possibility that if we're a little optimistic about space travel, you don't need a lot of civilization. If there's a lot of civilizations, if you assume that every civilization is able to reach a couple of its neighbors. Are there any, but of course this takes probably a very reasonable estimate, at least 100 years.
To propagate to nearby stars?
I think that's what David's pointing to, right?
Well, are there any halfway reasonable biological estimates of how long an organism can live? Because if it takes more than 100 years to get somewhere, nobody's going to go.
Well, it depends on how much you like natural environments compared to human-made environments, and your optimism about how we can create ecospheres that are, you know, on planets, on spacecraft. I myself tend to think, I personally wouldn't be that excited to go on a long duration space trip, because I think it must be akin to being on a Greyhound bus for quite a while. Yeah, with no
question.
Could be, but again, if you know, we're good at entertaining ourselves as well.
Suppose the psychological time is like 3 or 100,000 years. For you, it's like 100.
Oh, I see. So you mean your I don't know. I mean, I'm not particularly optimistic about space travel to nearby stars. I think it's going to be a long time. Because look at how long it's taken us to do what little space travel we've done in the solar system. I mean, we went to the moon in a span of 4 years, and we haven't been back. And so that's part of my reasoning in saying it's a lot more difficult than, and the motivation may not be there for having significant amounts of space travel.
Further questions?
So let me make an announcement. I usually organize a dinner with today's talk is of special interest. So the only thing unusual about today's dinner is that we have to be in a sports bar, which is a World Series. since I'm no way of estimating N, the number of people, could be anywhere from 1 to 50. If anybody is interested to...
Is that the dinner, Z equation?
if anybody is interested in time for dinner, please send me an email. And I guess I also strongly encourage the ITP participants in the superconductivity program to come just to bring a different... and of course, everyone is welcome. And in front of the ITP,
okay, good. Thanks. Thanks a lot. It's everybody's closet-setty person.